Hello, this is a Cranfield University podcast. I'm Steve McCauley, and I'm interviewing Professor Joan Ellis on his article, Winning the Future, A Business Overview. Now, Joe, one of the things that people are concerned about is the future. Managers are having to work with it every day, but they're also having to deal with the present, and that can take a lot of their time. One of the things that you did in the article was to look at past winners and then go on to look at people that are looking ahead and what they're doing. So let's start with the past. Looking back, who were the winners and why were they winners?
Yeah, rather than specify who the winners are, because there are so many of them, let's describe what they looked like. If we go back to the 60s, it was quite obvious that if you were a manufacturing company, large manufacturing company, you could make money because it was a time of building, a time of construction, and government contracts were very popular. So if I can just capture physical production companies in the 60s, were clearly the winners in that decade. But if I take you forward to the 70s, we had the emergence of Japanese companies, as it were, teaching us how to become winners. And I think that was more about recognizing the importance of efficiency and productivity. And so they brought with them, and they taught us, the importance of automation, etc. Process in terms of manufacturing. If I move to the 80s, there was quite a big change in the characteristics of winning organizations. There was a surge in the service sector, in particular banking and financial services. And I think what we saw there was a rush towards brand as being the difference between winners and losers. I guess that reflects the growing importance of consumers and with respect to brand. If I then move to the 90s, I think we've seen some remarkable developments. We've seen winners such as Tesco's come from nowhere to becoming a world brand. I suppose Walmart being the early example of that. And what I would describe as being the reason why winners have emerged in the 90s are the characteristics, is because they've identified something different. They've understood the importance of economies of scale. But for me, they've understood the importance of economies of scope. And by that I mean they've identified what they're good at and they've leveraged off that. So, for example, Tesco's is clearly good at retailing. The question then is, what can they retail? And they can retail almost anything they want to retail because they're good at retailing. Very simplistic view, I accept that. But that goes hand in hand with the importance of the customer, recognizing what the customer wants. The customer is king. And on top of all of that, of course, I think winning companies in the last decade, the 1990s, also appreciated the importance of technology, not physical technology, but technology in terms of understanding the customer, information management, leveraging off their asset, which was information. But I try to give you a very simplistic overview and a very rapid overview of the last three or four decades. And clearly, it's not a discrete set of time periods. There's a continuum there in terms of winning the past.
Now, most managers are experiencing change firsthand. Now, in your role in international economics, you've got quite a privileged view, really, of looking at the key trends that are driving change. What do you see are the main ones?
Well, at the top of the agenda is this word globalization. We are seeing, in a relatively short time period, changes in the global economy and global business environment that we could never have imagined in the past. The timescale is the issue. For example, the rebalancing of the world economy, the flood of capital and wealth from the West to the East, particularly, of course, China and India. So I think we're seeing a scale of change and a speed of change that we could not have imagined in the time period that has taken place. And that has created a whole new set of dynamics, including new markets all over the world, globalization, new consumers, new competitors, of course, and we're feeling the pressure of that in the Western world, and particularly in manufacturing, new assets. See, the physical product, the R&D within that, well, in a sense, technology transfer has made it possible for that asset to be transferred all over the world. And that's creating new business models, new ways of looking at how we run businesses, who our customers are. So I think really this is highlighted a dynamic, a speed of change that I don't think any manager 20 years ago could have visualized today. And that really highlights the importance, therefore, of recognizing where we are, recognizing the speed of change, recognizing the challenges of change, and then from that basis, identifying what winning the future looks like.
Now, if I'm an average manager, I've got enough on my plate looking at today and keeping up with the competition. And although some of these kind of big picture things that you're talking about are important, it's maybe easy to overlook those. What recipe would you apply that enables people to win the future, to look ahead?
Gosh, difficult question to answer, of course, but it's one we have to ask and attempt to answer it. Let me answer it indirectly this way. Let's visualize a company that has been successful and knows why it's successful. Let's assume that success has been based on quality. I'll take an example. Let's think of the top range cars, quality cars, which are clearly positioned at the high end of the market with premium prices, which obviously justifies or supports the differentiation strategy. But how many of us today would buy a car that doesn't work? Quality is no longer a differentiation. I would describe it as a commodity. And so in terms of winning the future, if you're relying on, as it were, your old source of competitive advantage, i.e. quality, then you've really got to assess whether or not that is sustainable. Another example would be airlines. 10 years ago, you can imagine being offered two airline tickets, one with a major carrier going from London to Paris, £300. Another one offering you a ticket at £5. You almost certainly wouldn't have chosen the £5 ticket because you wouldn't be sure of landing. You would doubt whether you can get an airline ticket at £5. Today, we now have airline tickets being sold for zero price, and nobody expects the plane to crash, or we hope it won't crash. So safety is no longer a measure of differentiation. It's a commodity. So in terms of really answering your question, what companies have to ask themselves is the source of our past success sustainable in the future? And I would ask them to challenge everything they do right through the organization. And in particular, I would ask them to ask their staff for ideas, new voices, new perspectives, new business models, new ways of looking at their business. So, for example, we'll all remember 10 years ago, if you could have bought one of the latest mobile phones, it would have cost you in the region of £300, £400, £500. Today, in this country, and in most Western countries, the price of a mobile phone is zero. You don't pay anything for it. Can you imagine 10 years ago working for a company that relied on selling mobile phones, suggesting, let's give them for free? They would think you're crazy. But today they are free because the business model has changed. And we now spend a lot more money on telephone calls. So really what I'm asking companies to do is to think, is their model sustainable? The way in which they generate profits, the type of customers, the type of products, the way they sell them, channels to market, is to challenge it, not for the sake of changing it, just for the sake of changing it, but to ask, is this sustainable? And I think in that context, they might be surprised, or they might awaken up to the reality that there are challenges that they don't yet know about. And I think that applies right across the board. And that has given rise to some new ideas, some new ways of thinking about business models. And one of these has, of course, become known as Blue Ocean Strategy or Blue Ocean Thinking.
Now, I've heard about that, but I don't really know much about it. There's words I've heard, and it's in your article, Blue Ocean, Red Ocean. These sound great terms. Tell me more about it.
Well, let's first of all be very clear. They are only terms. They're meant to provoke, to stimulate our imagination about our business models. So let's clarify that. Nice words, but what do they mean? That's the real issue. Let me clarify Red Ocean. That's simple. Red Ocean is where the sharks are eating each other. That's the world we are seeing today. It's always been the case, but we've now got more and more crowded marketplaces. more and more suppliers trying to serve, well, an existing customer base.
So Red Ocean is where many companies are now.
All companies, by definition, where margins are getting tighter, competition becoming more aggressive. There's a war going on for market share. And it's market share within a given market. Now, Blue Ocean is very different. Let me paraphrase it like this. How much money, how much business could you generate if you could create a need that people don't yet know they need? And if you are the one who creates that need, how much could you generate in terms of profit, revenue, and market?
I mean, that sounds wonderful. It sounds, maybe, if I may say so, a bit academic, in the sense that your average manager looking at this would say, wouldn't that be wonderful? But how on earth do I do that?
Well, very simple. The alternative word would be innovation, which is perhaps a more meaningful phrase. Let me give you a very, very simple example, just to, A, create some amusement, but also to graphically demonstrate how successful this can be. 20 years ago, the market for washed packaged salad was zero. It didn't exist. Today, that market is a multi-billion dollar market around the world. And what it has done, it has created a need that we didn't know we needed. Did we really need to buy washed salad? Well, you try and reverse that today and you will discover you would not be able to reverse that. So we've created a market out of nothing. Other trivial examples, electric toothbrushes, for example. I didn't know I needed electricity to wash my teeth. But where's the profit in that? The profit is now in the replacement heads. It's a huge margin. We now have razor blades that went from one blade to six blades, now with batteries. But once you create that need for this innovative product, people will tend not to reverse their needs because they get used to it. But let's expand into bigger aspects of this. I mentioned the mobile phone. By changing the business model, we have created a need for mobile phones and for communication that we could never have imagined. Think of what is the youngest child you know has a mobile phone? I suspect you'll tell me it's 5 or 6. Remove that mobile phone and see what happens. You have a problem. Even children now believe they need this. So what we see is innovation, not only in the product, but also in the way it's being sold, the business model, the profit streams. And we've created something that is now almost indispensable. You go on a train from London to Bedford to Cranfield, you will discover many people have two mobile phones. I often wonder who they're talking to. Is it their wife or is it somebody else at the same time? So we're now seeing needs that we could not possibly have, well, by definition, known about in the past. But once you do this, once you create that need, then I think the momentum is impressive. Perhaps one of the oldest examples, at least in the last 20 years, is Post-it paper. Who would have thought that a glue that didn't stick would become almost an indispensable product in every secretary's office? So what I'd like people to think about is not that this is difficult, but actually it's easy to do it. And the secret is to unlock that innovation in organizations. And if I could capture that with a concept, in every organization, and within every organization, in every individual, there is what I refer to as a creative gap. Let me define that very clearly. The creative gap is the gap between, well, the profits you make and profits you could make, or in not-for-profit organizations, the performance you achieve, performance you could achieve. So ask that question, have you got a gap? And the answer is yes. The challenge is, how do you close that gap? And that's part of what Blue Ocean is trying to do.
That's very interesting. I mean, what I'd like to do is to say, if you were to have, the whites of the eyes of the UK's top senior managers in here right now, and they would say to you, well, so what? What are the implications of this? What would you say to them?
Implications, let me identify those perhaps in terms of what I've called five new business realities. So the implications of this will emerge if you can identify what the new realities are you're facing and then challenge your organization. For example, I would like all organizations to to recognize that customers are not a market share. They are a franchise. Imagine you have a franchise which which is a license to operate today, but tomorrow it can be removed. Think of how you would treat your customers if they were a franchise and you could lose them tomorrow. That's a mindset, but that will change organizational thinking. Secondly, by definition, you know, if you can reduce costs, you should reduce costs to be more efficient. So that's a given. But have you really thought about what it is that makes you successful? What is your core competency? And can you leverage off that? That's what I mean by economies of scope. That's the second point. So do you really understand what makes you successful? And unless we ask that question, then we'll never be able to leverage off it. Thirdly, you know, you need to recognize that markets are becoming more and more and more fragmented. So an offering to a market segment in the past may not be appropriate in the future, because that segment may be now several different fragments. People want more and more individuality. At least my fourth thought or reality is that there is a massive shift from the emphasis on mass production to what is now called mass customization. That may be a perception, but if you can get your customers to feel that they are getting personal attention, personal products, then I think you've got a success to build on. For example, Dell, you know, you build your own computer as you order it. Toyota cars, you know, are built to order to a certain extent, as opposed to the mass production, all the same color every day. And last but not least, which is a bit of a play on words, there's no question that in the past, the emphasis on product technology has been a success factor. The better the technology, the bigger the advantage you've got. But technology is now transferable across the world. I would like companies to think about, not about product technology, but what I call market technology. What I mean by that is, it's a play on words, I said. It's to spend more time understanding the mechanics of the market, what the market is thinking, how it behaves, what its needs are, what its future needs will be to create new markets. That takes a lot of effort and time. So how do you achieve that, of course, is a big question. I think you first of all have to recognize that, you know, have you got the right people in the organization to help you think that way? If organizations recruit people who look like the existing staff, you're simply cloning the existing model. Companies like Microsoft, I think, are very good at identifying the importance of attracting people with different mindsets. So if you need more creativity to think through these issues, you need more creative people. But if you're in the business of, you know, the IT business, that doesn't mean you need more computer programmers. Or if you're in financial services, you don't need more accountants or more finance people. You need people who are more creative. People such as artists, linguists, musicians. They tend to think differently. So if you need a different business model, consider your employment, your recruitment strategies, and are you recruiting people who perhaps think differently from the way you think as a means of achieving some of this blue ocean thinking?
Great. Well, thank you very much, Professor Nellis. I think what you've done is given a very challenging agenda for the future, and a very practical one to move forward.
Thank you.